Welcome, everyone, to the September meeting of the Senate Committee on Business, Transportation, and Economic Development. We've got a long list of informational meetings scheduled today, so I think we'll go ahead and get started. Now, Patrick, who do we have up first?
First up will be Travis Brower from Federal Affairs Advisor for ODOT to talk about the new federal highway reauthorization. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Hi, Travis.
Hello.
Didn't I just see you yesterday?
You may have.
So I may have told you something very similar.
Chair Brower, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Travis Brower. I'm ODOT's Federal Affairs Advisor. I'm here to tell you a little bit about the new Federal Surface Transportation Bill, MAP 21, which stands for Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century. And we would agree that this bill, which took Congress 3 years, but hey, who's counting, really does help move the transportation system forward and does make progress for our transportation system. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about some of the major accomplishments of MAP 21 and then be able to answer any of your questions. Probably the most important thing about MAP 21 is that it provides stable funding for transportation, for highways, for safety, and for public transportation, but only in the short term, and that's a very important point. MAP 21 authorizes the federal surface transportation programs, highways, safety, and transit, for the next two federal fiscal years. That's federal fiscal year 13 and federal fiscal year 14. And the federal fiscal year starts in a couple of weeks, so really MAP 21 will cover the next 2 years. Over that time, the funding for the federal highway program will be essentially flat. Fiscal year 2013 is set at the same level as fiscal year 12, which was, in fact, a cut from the previous year. And that was about a 7% reduction. So we're actually down over the last few years. We've included a chart in your testimony that shows you the level of Oregon's federal highway funding over the last several years. And what you can see is that from the high watermark in 2010, 2011 was a slight decline, 2012 again was about a 7% cut, and then 13 and 14 will be essentially flat. That's not too bad, though. Someone once recently told me that in the public sector, flat is the new up, and so we'll take it. And it is a lot better than the one-third cut in transportation funding that the House of Representatives was pushing for a year ago. So we're actually fairly pleased with staying flat. One of the reasons why we're not too upset about being flat is that Oregon is actually going to receive a larger share of the funding than in the past. Due to some rather helpful features of the formula, we're going to get a few thousandths of a percent more than we normally would. And, you know, a few thousandths may sound kind of minor, but when you think about a $40 billion federal program, a thousandth of a percent is $400,000. So you add up a few thousandths and you actually get some serious money. It's worth about $27 million each year in getting a larger share of the funding. And you can thank Congressman DeFazio for that. So run into him one of these days, give him a big hug, and thank him for bringing more federal funding back to Oregon. The really important part about MAP 21, though, to remember is it really is just short-term stability. They did not provide the long-term sustainable funding needed to ensure that we have transportation funding going into the future. The Highway Trust Fund on an annual basis is running about a $12 billion deficit, where the funding level approved by Congress is that much higher than the amount of revenue coming in primarily from the federal gas tax and diesel tax. As a result, over time, they've had to make a number of transfers from other sources into the Highway Trust Fund, largely repaying it for interest owed and some things like that. In MAP 21, the only way they were able to avoid deep cuts of about 20% to 30% was to transfer $20 billion into the Highway Trust Fund from the general fund from a number of sources. And that money will run out in 2 years. We're looking at a situation where at the end of MAP 21, the Federal Highway Trust Fund will once again get down to about a zero balance and possibly could even dip below it before that. So right 2 years from now, we'll be back to having a significant shortfall in the Highway Trust Fund. And in that situation, Congress will either have to find additional revenue to put into the Highway Trust Fund or cut programs once again. And it'll probably be somewhere in the range of about a 25% cut. If you look at the chart we provided, that shows you in 2015 and beyond, there's significant uncertainty as a result of that. And we could see Oregon's federal highway funding fall by over $100 million a year, which would seriously constrain our ability to build a lot of of capital projects. Since the federal funding that we receive is the basis of our statewide transportation improvement program, our STIP, is essentially most of our capital funding moving forward, that would have a major impact on the state. One of the other major accomplishments in MAP 21 was that it provides greater flexibility for states and local governments to invest in priority areas. Previously, the federal highway and federal transit program structures were really complicated. There were a whole bunch of little obscure programs and lots of little set-asides that directed money to various parts of the transportation system. In MAP 21, they generally consolidated those programs, got rid of most of those, and then gave us the eligibility to fund projects across the highway and transit systems from those programs so that we have more flexibility to meet the needs that we view as priorities. For example, there used to be a federal bridge program that set a level of funding for bridges in a state. They got rid of that and folded it in with some other programs that are focused on the national highway system. And so now the goal is to keep your national highway system routes, which are the primary routes that connect major communities and parts of the state, keep those in a state of good condition. And if you need to spend a little bit more on bridges, you can. If you don't need to spend quite as much on bridges because maybe your pavements need a little bit more work, then you can do that. And it's also important to note that virtually all of the money now will flow through state DOTs and MPOs, so Metropolitan Planning Organizations. In the past, a lot of the money was broken off into earmarks or discretionary programs, and now we have the flexibility to spend that money as we need to on priority projects. Along with that accountability, along with that flexibility, however, comes a greater level of accountability. In the past, the federal highway and transit programs weren't really that outcome focused. The federal government didn't really require states to measure outcomes or hold them accountable for the results. And I say that, but at the same time, most states actually did have a pretty good performance management program. Oregon, for example, last year was rated in a national report as one of the top six states in the nation in terms of its performance management program. We have a very robust set of key performance measures and targets and tracking systems to make sure we're spending our money effectively. MAP 21 will create a federal performance management system, and under that system, USDOT is going to set various measures for bridge condition, pavement condition, performance of the interstate, and mobility of freight, some other areas. States then will be able to set their own targets based on their own conditions, and then we'll have to report to USDOT on how they're doing in terms of meeting those conditions, much as we do with our current state performance management system. There really aren't any financial penalties, but there are some accountability measures where if some of the system conditions slip below certain thresholds, you may have to spend more on those. For example, bridges on the national highway system. If your bridges deteriorate below a certain level, then you're going to have a larger spending target there. Another major important feature of MAP 21 is its focus on freight. And for a state like Oregon with a traded sector economy, this is really important and something we advocated for. MAP 21, for the first time, really puts in place a federal freight policy. And it's sort of surprising they hadn't done this before now, because if there's one thing it would seem like the federal government would have an interest in, it's ensuring the smooth and efficient movement of interstate commerce. But this is really the first time that Congress has created a freight framework at the federal level. What they will be doing in this framework is developing a national strategic freight plan that will look at bottlenecks and needs for investment on the national freight network. They will also be designating a national freight network that will include the highest priority routes across the nation that carry most of the freight. Things like I-5 and I-84, we believe, will probably both be included in that national freight network. And then they'll set performance measures, and they will measure how well freight is moving, and then states will have to report on that. Unfortunately, there was a freight program included in the Senate version of MAP 21, but in the conference committee, they killed that off because they said, we're only killing programs, we're not creating new ones. So there isn't any money to go along with the freight investment framework that they're creating. But you can see how creating a national strategic plan that really identified where the needs for freight investment would be could help in the long term with ensuring that money does flow from states and the federal government to some of the freight bottlenecks and other needs on the freight system. Another one of the major accomplishments in MAP 21 is further streamlining project delivery processes. MAP 21 has a whole section that is devoted to looking at the federal environmental and regulatory permitting processes and trying to find ways to streamline some of those. For example, one of the provisions included in the bill is that it will allow states to purchase right-of-way property for projects before the environmental process is completed in some limited circumstances. So that could help a project move forward a little bit faster, because when you finish your environmental assessment or your environmental impact statement, you actually have a lot of the property purchased and you can go move forward a little bit quicker. There's also more projects will qualify as what's known as a categorical exclusion, which means that you don't have to go through as lengthy an environmental assessment process if it's a fairly typical project. You know, your basic pavement project or a bike lane or, you know, something within the highway right-of-way, more of those will qualify. And so we think that overall this will probably contribute to further streamlining the project delivery process. There was already some streamlining that was included in the last bill, which was known as Safety Lieu. The administration has also undertaken some additional streamlining under the Everyday Counts initiative. So all told, we think this will help get projects out the door a bit faster and save some money. We're looking to utilize these new opportunities aggressively. In the past, ODOT has been a leader in finding ways to save time and save money in delivering projects while also improving environmental outcomes. We did that under the OTIA 3 program, and I think this will give us some additional opportunities to do that. The last area that I think is a major accomplishment for MAP 21 is financing assistance for major projects. There was really only one program that received a significant boost in funding, and that is what's known as the Transportation Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act, or TIFIA. It is a FHWA, Federal Highway Administration, loan financing program that provides loans and loan guarantees for projects of national significance. This probably won't be that beneficial to most projects in the state because it really is for larger projects that have some sort of revenue stream, a la tolls. But for the Columbia River Crossing, this is huge in the sense that the funding for TIFIA was increased sevenfold. And so over the next 2 years, the Federal Highway Administration can make about $17 billion in loans. The Columbia River Crossing was looking at a loan that would be used to, or tolls would be used to pay back a loan. We were thinking with the size of the TIFIA program, you know, we might be able to get a $500 million loan. With this expansion, we think that we can probably get up to $1 billion, maybe even a little bit more in a TIFIA loan. And that's really important because TIFIA comes with very favorable financing terms, lower interest rates, longer repayment periods, lower coverage rates that allow you to leverage more cash. It's a lot like a mortgage. You know, if you have a lower interest rate, you can buy more house for the same payment. So we'll be able to use tolls to pay back a TIFIA loan and leverage a lot more cash from that loan. We're estimating currently that a TIFIA loan could leverage about 25% more cash even than general obligation bonds, which are even better than tollback bonds, which are a little bit riskier and thus they charge a higher interest rate. What that means is that for the CRC, it's probably up to maybe nearly $200 million in additional cash that could be leveraged from the tolling revenue stream, so that the tolling revenue may be able to get toward the higher end of our estimates rather than on the lower side. So that gives you a good sense of some of what's in this 584-page bill. And obviously, since it weighs about 10 pounds, I couldn't cover all the details of the bill, but I think that gives you a good sense, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I have one, Travis. How much of the money on a national level is designated, actually controlled, if you will, by the MPOs, mm-hmm. the state, and then the feds?
Chair Beyer, I don't know numbers nationwide. I believe that at least of the total Federal Highway Administration funding, it's about 95% or more that will be distributed to states via formula programs. So it's a very large portion. In Safety Lieu, it was under 90% because so much money was through earmarks and discretionary grant programs. Within Oregon, I ran the numbers the other day, and about 7.5% of the funding will go through the metropolitan planning organizations. That's up from about 6.5% under Safety Lieu in 2012. However, that's not all of the money that goes to local governments. ODOT shares federal highway funding with local governments beyond just the MPOs. Under the bridge, we have a local bridge program. We've had a transportation enhancements program for bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure, and as well as we share a portion of what's known as the surface transportation program. So overall, local governments in Oregon typically get 20% to 25% of the federal highway funding, and probably 99% of the Federal Transit Administration funding that comes to the state.
And that's just solely their discretion?
Chair Beyer, under some of the programs, it's solely their discretion. For example, the Surface Transportation Program funds that are shared with MPOs and cities and counties, they have discretion on how to spend that money. Some of that money goes through statewide distribution processes. For example, the bridge program. We have a local agency bridge selection committee where ODOT and local governments get together and, using some criteria, pick the most important high-priority bridges to fix.
Fred?
Thank you, Chair Barr. Actually, I'm going to ask, I think, the same question, but of the MAP 21 money, how much of that, I would assume that that all has to go to federal highways. Is that correct?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, generally, yes. The MAP 21 money has to go to what's known as the federal aid highway system. However, that includes most major streets. For example, you know, State Street out front is almost certainly a federal aid highway route.
Oh, okay.
And so local governments and the state can spend that. One thing I will tell you is ODOT, most of the money ODOT will receive is from a program called the National Highway Performance Program, which is focused on the national highway system. That is a network of routes, everything from, you know, the interstate to Highway 22 going through Salem, that carry most freight traffic and are the key connecting routes between communities. And so most of the money will be directed there. I think it's about 55% to 60% of that money will go to those routes, because those really are the key nationally significant routes.
Then I hate to bring up something controversial, but the Columbia River crossing is you know, kind of on the minds of everyone. The last price tag I saw was $3.5 billion. There's a lot of people doing a lot of calculations and assuming that the state's going to finance their end of the bargain. I just like to know what is the state's obligation in that money, you know?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, we had the Oversight Committee meeting yesterday, and we talked about the state's portion of the CRC would be about $450 million from some sort of highway revenue type bond, which is, you know, about a penny and a half gas tax or other type of registration fee or title fee could pay that sort of level of debt. It's, you know, relatively small in comparison to the size of, say, the OTIA 3 program.
I'm a rural legislator, and I just want it on the record that if we're going to spend that kind of money, I really think you have to have that it has to be balanced throughout the state. So, you know, if you want to increase and make a four-lane between Lincoln City and Bend or something down in Senator Atkinson's district, I just feel that we have to do that. To spend it all in one spot, it's a little bit trying. You know, I have people from Idana that probably would never use the bridge. So I understand that it's a great project. I really want it. But the price tag at $450 million, when we're really hurting for money, and then it's just all located in one spot, I just have some concerns about it. I'm not saying I'm opposed to it. I'm just saying that we, you know, we have to distribute the money a little more equitable through the state.
Yeah. Senator Beyer, or Chair Beyer, Senator Girod, one of the opportunities on the Columbia River crossing is that with an investment from the state, we can likely leverage significant additional federal money. You know, in the $850 million, we're looking for light rail, a significant loan, and toll revenue. So for a investment of $450 million, the state can get a project that it would create significant numbers of jobs in Oregon.
Senator Atkinson?
Could you give us a thumbnail sketch of the support that this has with our federal delegation?
Mm-hmm. Chair Senator Atkinson, every member of Oregon's delegation voted for MAP 21. It ended up being a, or are you talking about the Columbia River Crossing or the...
Both.
The MAP 21 was supported broadly in Congress. It ended up being a bipartisan bill with broad bipartisan support. Every member of the Oregon delegation supported the bill, and all of them had the opportunity to put their stamp on it. For example, Congressman Walden helped with ensuring continued flow of funding for the Federal Lands Highway Program, which provides funding for roads that access the national forests and BLM lands. And Senator Merkley helped in a whole variety of ways. Congressman DeFazio helped with the formula funding coming to the state. And as for the Columbia River Crossing, I'll tell you that Congressional delegation is very strongly supportive of the CRC. They recognize that it is one of the most important transportation projects in the nation, which is something that USDOT has also recognized, and they have worked to ensure that this legislation sets the framework that will help the CRC move forward.
Other questions? Thank you, Travis. Great job. Next up, Patrick, looks like you got a project update.
Yeah, Paul Mathers here to give us an update on major projects.
Good morning, Paul.
Good morning.
So this is kind of our quarterly update on what's happening.
Chair Byer, members of the committee, Paul Mather, Highway Division Administrator for ODOT. Just give you the quarterly update on projects, quickly walk through our Jobs and Transportation Act, OTIA, various projects, just to give you an overview on where we are. In your handout that or testimony that I have there, you'll see a couple attachments. One lists our quarterly report on all the Jobs and Transportation Act projects, and then as well as a summer construction map, just to give you an idea of the work that we have currently underway. Start with some of the Jobs and Transportation Act projects. Just a quick overview. Again, it was passed in the 09 session, Jobs and Transportation Act, and there were specific projects that were identified in the bill. I'm going to talk about several of those. Most of the ones that you'll see in the report that are either completed or well underway, I would describe as some of our easier or low-hanging fruit projects that we're able to get underway relatively quickly. What's going to happen in the next 12 months, a number of the major projects, the projects that required various environmental documents, are going to get underway. So you're going to see a lot of activity in these major projects starting. Some of those I've got listed there are Sunrise Corridor, the Chute Road Project on Highway 26, the Woodburn Interchange, Newburgh-Dundee, Beltline Interchange on I-5, Kubler Interchange here in Salem, Fern Valley just south of Medford on I-5, the Biggs Interchange on 84, Climbing Lane just out of the Grand. So many of those are major projects that we've been working on for a number of years, and communities have had a lot of work and support for those projects. After that time frame, and just linking back a little bit to Travis's presentation, after that time frame of the next couple of years and those projects go out to bid, and we move outside of MAP 21, MAP 21 provides stable funding for the next couple of years, we go right back into a scenario where now we have no funding at the state level for a bonded program, and we're at risk of lesser funding at the federal level, and we're preparing for an organization to be smaller, frankly, to prepare for that smaller workload that we would have with a number of projects. So just to give you a glimpse of where we're going. So one, just walking through a few of the projects.
Question, with the funding streams, the OTIA projects going back and everything, did we made major improvements along and fixing some of the deteriorating bridges and roads, and I guess kind of where's the gap? Now are we back into maintenance then, or we still have some major projects on the list?
Senator Byer, that's a good point. I would describe on the bridge side, that the work we've been doing over the last 10 years with the TO3 bridge bill, that we've stabilized in the short term our bridge needs. Long term, we have huge deficits in our bridge program. Again, pointing back to the report that we did in the 03 session, we identified $5 billion worth of bridge needs in the state. We strategically picked out the $1.3 billion on the strategic freight routes that we could afford to do, and so we've done those. But that additional liability is still out there, and that's going to catch up to us going forward. But in the short term, our bridge conditions are going to be relatively stable. From a modernization standpoint, the Jobs and Transportation Act put a shot in the arm of many of these major projects that were kind of on the cusp or needed the last bit of funding to get funded. But from my concern, it's really of the condition of the overall system in our base program that continues to be eaten away by the reduction in funding we see from reduced receipts in the gas tax, both at the state and federal level, as well as inflation eating away at that. But if our basic just maintenance and operation funds in our system, whether it's maintaining pavements, maintaining culverts, signals, there's a growing liability or growing concern out there of just the overall condition of the system. That's a concern. So moving on to just briefly on some of the projects, the first one I was going to touch on is the Glencoe Road interchange. This is a $32 million project that went to bid this last spring. This is just a picture of the construction. This project is on Highway 26, just out of North Plains. This interchange serves both North Plains, Hillsboro, Forest Grove, and Cornelius. Here's just a quick snapshot. It's a project that basically does upgrades to the interchange to improve facilitation of traffic in that area and using Highway 26. The next project, just to touch on Newburgh-Dundee, this has been a long-standing project that hit two major milestones this last summer. First was the completion of the environmental document and the signature on the record of decision at the federal level in June, and then in August we received final approval of the GO exception from the Yamhill County Commission. So we had a little celebration out there a few weeks ago, just recognizing that next spring we'll see construction actually beginning on this project. We've split the work up into many different contracts, some of them smaller, just to encourage as many different contractors in Oregon able to compete on this project.
Nice shovels.
How long is the bypass?
In total miles?
What will be constructed?
I don't have the total miles. If you can visualize, say, on the north end or the Portland end, we'll utilize a city street to connect to the bypass. We'll construct a segment of the bypass that goes around Newburgh and just around Dundee, and then on the south side of Dundee will be a new signalized intersection that will bring the bypass back into the existing 99. Mm-hmm. So it's probably 3 or 4 miles in further length to the south that we have plans for the project that we had to shorten up. This, like many of the projects, we anticipate a federal earmark to help construct more of the project that we weren't able to construct. Also, the environmental documents assumes a four-lane facility. We're building a two-lane facility with this bypass for now, with the ability to expand it to four lanes in the future.
So you got enough right-of-way to go to four?
We'll purchase the right-of-way for the entire project, but just build the two-lane rather than the four-lane with the funds that we have.
Look at the suits on the edges.
Woodburn Interchange, this is a project that's going to be going to bid later on next year. It's a project, it's one of those projects, again, that we were assuming a federal earmark for that we did not get, and we have about a $10 million funding gap on this project. Like Newburgh-Dundee and Sunrise and many of our other projects, we've been able to apply the practical design principles that were also in the Jobs and Transportation Act, or just simply scale the project back to meet within the dollars available. For the Woodburn Interchange project, we weren't able to do that. We have about a $10 million gap on this project that we're going to need to fill before this project goes to bid. We were able to get $3.3 million of additional federal funds last month through an appropriation, but we still have that $10 million gap for
Woodburn. So when will that go to bid?
It's in spring of next year.
So construction starting that summer?
So next construction season, yeah. First construction season will be next summer. Correct. So we'll be having more conversations with you about how ideas about how to fill that $10 million gap on this project. Moving to the OTIA 3 bridge program, I've talked a little bit about that, but this, again, was passed in the O3 session. We've identified 365 bridges on those strategic state routes. By the end of this construction season, that program will be essentially done, except for two major bridges that have 4 to 5 year construction seasons on them. The Sandy River Bridge project is one of those, and the other is the project in Eugene over the Lambert River Bridge. But for all intents and purposes, this program will be completed. It's a project that, or a program that continues to run under budget, so we anticipate some savings with this program. So just talking about a couple of bridges, a couple of those bigger bridges, the Sandy River Bridge. This is on 84 just outside of Troutdale. This is a photograph earlier this summer. This bridge you see under construction, actually about any day now, will carry traffic on it, both eastbound and westbound, and will really mark the kind of the halfway point on this project. Here's some of those large beams that will be going in place. Again, this will be open to traffic by the end of the month. The Lambert River Bridge in Eugene, this is a picture of the one of the new structures that's complete. It's now carrying both north and south traffic on I-5. And here's the twin structure to it that's under construction to carry the northbound traffic. Both these projects continue to move along very well. Very complicated projects, long construction seasons, in-water work periods, and other complications to them, but continue to move along very, very nicely for us. The last project I want to touch on was this Pioneer Mountain project that I talked about last spring. As you remember, last spring talked about our termination agreement that we had with the contractor. We completed that termination agreement. ODOT has had control of the site. We have let a contract this summer for a contractor to be out there to stabilize the slopes in the area and begin doing some of the prep work for the realignment or the regrading of the project to lower the grade of the alignment. That additional project is under design right now and will be under construction next summer. Our overall plan with the project is to have it open to traffic by the end of 2015. Moving on to the last thing I just want to touch on is Connect Oregon. In the last legislative session, there was $40 million approved for Connect Oregon projects. Our Transportation Commission approved 38 projects for those funds. There was 64 total applications, totaling over $71 million for those. So it continues to be a strong appetite for Connect Oregon or non-highway type projects that are out there. So that's just a quick overview of projects and work we have underway.
Thank you.
Prepared to answer any questions.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Patrick, looks like next we got the Road User Task Force. Mr. Witte.
Task Force. Awesome.
I've been looking.
Oh, there he is.
This is one that's actually been done. Okay. So when do I get the transponder, Witte?
You didn't do it.
Are you doing a transponder?
You know, my car is not new enough, Mr. Chair.
I'm not familiar with this.
So I'll just go from beginning up on the top toolbar right there. Down and to your left. Click that right there. Okay.
All right.
Good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is James Witte. I'm the manager of ODOT's Office of Innovative Partnerships and Alternative Funding. I'm here today, though, to speak about the work of the Road User Fee Task Force since last May. As committee may remember, the task force was established by the Oregon legislature in 2001, and four state legislators sit on it, one from each caucus, and two transportation commissioners, and then another member from the cities, one from the counties, and then four at large. The task force has been busy at work trying to design an alternative to the gas tax for highly fuel-efficient vehicles that either don't pay the gas tax or pay very little. And it has established a pilot project that will start next month called the Road User Charge Pilot Project. It will demonstrate the rudiments of a future road user charging system. There are four things that will be demonstrated. One, an open system that will enable marketplace involvement in the pilot, rather than having some kind of a government-selected technology. The idea is to let the marketplace provide the technologies and have the consumers choose what kind of technologies they want to use. There'll be four mileage reporting options, which I'll get to in a moment. There'll be private sector administration as an alternative to the government provision of administration, and it'll also show a multi-state application. Since May, we've selected three firms to provide some of the technologies: Sanef, IMS, and Raytheon. CH2M Hill will operate the pilot for ODOT, and then D'Artagnan will provide the tax accounting. There are almost 50 volunteers, and I have to say 11 of them are state legislators, and a number of those are sitting on this committee. Thank you for your volunteering. There will be many vehicle types in the test, however, because we need to have a good showing, and we can't just isolate certain types of vehicles for the test. The volunteers will actually pay 1.56 cents per mile and get a fuel tax rebate. And Washington State and Nevada will join the pilot. They'll manage their own participants or paying for their own involvement. They will not be able, their participants will not be able to pay the charge because they don't have legislative authority to do that, whereas Oregon does. But they'll receive illustrative billings that will look the same as ours. The volunteers will sign a simple contract by the end of this month. Then they'll enroll online, choose a method of reporting from four basic options. Here they are. The first option, called the basic plan, and it doesn't have any GPS technology in the device at all. As a matter of fact, I've got it right here. I've been testing it in my car, and I just pulled it out this morning to bring on and show it to you. We can pass it around if you like, Mr. Chair. So that with that one, it'll tally all miles and then report that wirelessly to the tax processor. So there's no differentiation by location. Now the second one is the smartphone plan. This one also has no GPS technology in it, but it has the ability to connect to an app in a smartphone. So if somebody wants to drive out of, if somebody wants to drive out of state and they don't want to have all their miles counted, they can activate that app, and then their miles out of state will be excluded. It's their choice, not ours, to do that. The fourth option is the advanced plan that does have GPS in it. If people want to choose that, this will enable people to not count their miles driven on off public roads and out of state. The fourth option allow people to buy out of the system altogether and have no involvement with any kind of technology. It's a prepaid flat rate plan. It's a fairly large number. It's about $45 a month times the number of months in the pilot. And I doubt people will choose that, but it is an option. Installation is quite easy. My wife and I did it. We spend most of the time of the 5 minutes doing it, looking at the book for the car, trying to find the onboard diagnostic for it. And we should have just felt for it. It only took us a minute to find it, and then a second to put it in. It's a very, very simple process. In the fall, we'll have help desk available to help anybody who is in part involved with the pilot, so make sure it goes easy. And it, with legislators, we'll assign ODOT staff to make sure that we can have a visit if you need it to make sure it goes simple. The second selection will be whether to choose the private sector firm SANF or ODOT as your tax processor and account manager. So that's the second one. This is just a rudiments of a future system. The future system will actually have more options from the marketplace. For example, there'll be an iPhone app for the smartphone option. There'll be telematics from OnStar, Ford Sync, Nissan Car Wings, that kind of thing that are coming in more and more cars that'll be able to do this. And then ODOT believes we should have a non-onboard unit-based method so that nobody has to put anything in their car. They can avoid that, and so we want to develop that as well. The other work we're doing in advance of the session, see the pilot program begins in October, and there'll be a fleet forecast we hope to present in December that will predict future revenues, an urban and rural analysis which will tell us the impact on urban drivers versus rural drivers. The pilot program will end by January 31, and then we have a report for you the first week of February. This is all in preparation for legislation that the Road User Fee Task Force wants to put before the legislature in February that will start the system, if enacted by the legislature, with highly fuel-efficient vehicles with a particular emphasis on electric vehicles and plug-in hybrid electrics. So that concludes my testimony, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Jim, the rate per mile that's targeted to mirror what?
It is the rate per mile was actually chosen last year in the 2011 session by the House Revenue Committee to mirror the what the average motor vehicle pays in gas tax. And so since we didn't have any other way to choose a rate, we simply used what the Revenue Committee chose last year.
Senator Rye?
I would just like to know if we didn't kind of overthink the problem here, and if battery cars are the cause or electric cars are the concern, why not just tax the battery? And that's my question to you, is doesn't that seem a lot easier to you? It seems easier to me than to going through the high-tech process.
Mr. Chair, Senator Girard, the task force, and this has been going on for a while, the task force decided a while back that it should have a user-based system, user-paid system, similar to the gas tax, because we've been working with a user-based system since the gas tax was enacted in 1919. So that's why it chose that system. There are alternatives. I mean, it's true. There are alternatives to a user-based system. But the task force felt obligated to go with what our policy has been since 1919.
But a tax on the battery is a user-based because the battery only has so much life. And so it would seem to me like that would be user-based as well.
I can't, Mr. Chair, Senator Drew, I can't really respond to the nature of a user-based system using a battery at the moment. But it's intriguing. I just don't know how it would stack up with a metering system.
Any other questions? Thank you, Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Access management.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chair, Chair Byer, members of the committee, my name is Bob Bryant. I'm a region manager for the Oregon Department of Transportation. Been working for the director's office on the topic of access management now for a little while. Wanted to just give you a quick background and update this morning on how the work is going and the progress that's been made there. First of all, just a real quick background in the work. You'll recall that in special session, the 2010 special session, Senate Bill 1024 was passed, which directed ODOT to codify, clarify, and bring consistency in working with stakeholders on how the department issues access permits to the state highway. And the summer of that year, 2010, we brought together a group of stakeholders and have been working with that group of stakeholders pretty much consistently ever since. That work resulted in Senate Bill 1024 or 264, which was passed in the 2011 session and went into effect in January, on January 1st, 2012, as a temporary rule. We passed, continued the rulemaking process and put that rule into a permanent status, made effective July 1st of this year. The changes were quite substantial in the way that the department has managed access and permitting for access in the past. It was a substantial shift from our traditional focus on traffic safety and operations on the highway to provide much better balance between traffic safety and operations and the importance of land use and the potential for economic development opportunities on abutting properties that are abut the state highway. There is some of the highlights out of the work that was embedded in Senate Bill 264 and now been put into rule. First of all, it emphasizes the importance of a collaborative process, both with our local government partners, but stakeholders as well. And it introduces a new dispute review process, such that if we aren't able to conclude in a favorable outcome, presents an opportunity for the landowner to bring in a third party to review the decisions, the process, and the decisions that the department went through in working with that landowner on their application permit. It also created a set of objective standards as directed, which we will use to issue or make decisions around issuing permits, which eliminates a process that was used prior, which was to look at alternative access before we made a decision on whether or not to support additional access onto the state highway. This was a significant issue to stakeholders, and with the creation of the objective standards, we essentially eliminated the look at whether or not there was alternative access to a secondary system as part of that decision process. In addition to the standards, we created a set of criteria for evaluating safety and operations in addition to or outside of the standards themselves. There was a lot of interest, of course, by the department, but also by our stakeholders to make sure that at the end of the day, we were not creating an unsafe situation. And there are so many unique factors in different applications and locations where applications for new access are introduced, that we wanted the ability to evaluate sort of on a case-by-case basis what the potential is for safety and operations. And so we came up with our stakeholders with a explicit set of criteria that we would use to ensure that we weren't creating an unsafe situation by simply utilizing the fixed standards that we've got now for making decisions around access. We also, with the idea of creating less burden on the landowner or developer, shifted the responsibility for evaluating that traffic safety and operational issues from the private sector, from the developer landowner to the Department of Transportation. So now the responsibility would be ODOT's to do the analysis, do the work, and determine whether or not there is a safety issue that would influence the decision to whether or not to support an additional driveway application. In addition, we also scaled back the requirements that we've had in the past for requiring traffic impact analyses, which again was a responsibility typically of the developer, a burden both in terms of cost as well as timelines for the development community. And so we developed some criteria whereby we would not require a traffic impact analysis in every situation. It would only be those larger, more significant developments that we would work with the developer landowner on putting together a traffic impact analysis. We also, there were a couple of specific provisions in the bill, the original bill, Senate Bill 1024, that was passed in the 2010 special session, that required the department to revise the threshold that we use for a change of use condition. This is where a landowner has a business, has a use on their property, but they want to expand their use, they want to do an addition to or increase the size of their business that would likely then have an impact on the number of trips across the driveway in which it was permitted for originally. So we have a threshold whereby if it creates a certain number of increased trips across that driveway, the landowner is required to come back in and reapply for their permit. Senate Bill 1024 essentially doubled that threshold. Traditionally, historically, we also only focused the change of use condition on properties that already had a permitted driveway. In other words, for properties that had a business and a driveway that was not permitted, we would require them to go through the full process in order to be able to get their driveway permitted. With the change of use, with the changes to our rules around this change of use condition, we enabled not only properties with driveways that were permitted, but also driveways that had no permit or no documentation that would support them to use a less rigorous, we call it moving in the direction of criteria. So rather than using the full standards that were created, we've got a set of criteria that's less rigorous for a driveway that's been in existence, and it applies whether the driveway was previously permitted or not. Anecdotally, we've heard positive comments from the development community, from local governments, from our local partners on how well things are going. Obviously, today there's not a lot of development activity. There's not a big demand for right now for permitting new access or applications coming through the door. But where we have seen them, where we have had opportunities to work with communities, developers, landowners, we've gotten some pretty positive feedback on the shift that we're making. Again, fairly significant from where we were before and focusing almost entirely on traffic safety and operations to where we are today in trying to balance traffic and safety and operations with the importance of the economic development opportunities of those properties. We've gone through a concerted effort, very rigorous effort, to provide training to ODOT staff, the folks at the counter that work directly with landowners and developers, to make sure they were aware of the importance of this shift from where we've been in managing decisions around access permitting to where we are today. And we will continue that process. So what's next? We've got some additional work to do. We've got part of Senate Bill 1024 enacted a legislative oversight task force that was made effective earlier this year and has assisted both the stakeholder committee that we've utilized as well as the department in managing sort of the process through the rulemaking. And now we are looking at what additional work needs to be done. We've identified three specific topics that we'd like to work on with the stakeholders, or that they've identified that they'd like to work on. And so we've been engaged and utilizing the Oversight Task Force, again, to kind of help us manage through working through these three final topics. One is unpermitted driveways. I've mentioned them already as they apply to a change of use condition, but there was also a concern that where you've got an existing property and an existing use on a property with a driveway where there is no change and the driveway is not permitted or doesn't have any documentation that would support the driveway, that we, again, rather than use the full set of standards for something that's been in existence, have some less rigorous process for enabling us to grandfather or get those driveways permitted. First topic. Second topic is around the decisions that are made to manage access associated with interchanges and the planning process that we use for managing operations around an interchange, interchange area management plans, and the access management plan that is associated with the interchange area management plans. And so we're working on better criteria for the department to manage the types of decisions that affect access when we're talking about interchanges. And then the third topic that we're working on is just in project delivery. Again, the focus of the work with stakeholders that led to Senate Bill 264 is on the permitting process, permitting new approaches, but we felt like we needed to go back and look at the process that we use for making decisions when we're developing new projects, improvements to the highway, and the decisions that affect driveways as part of a project. So those are the three topics that we're working on. The expectation is that as we develop solutions or changes around those three topics, that with the help of the Oversight Task Force, we will formulate additional legislation, hopefully in time such that we can bring that work to the legislature during the 2013 session. Mm. With that, I will pause and see if there's any questions.
Let's go ahead, Mr. Whitlow.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Whitlow. I'm a land use attorney with the law firm of Perkins Coie in their Portland office. I'm representing the private sector interests on these committees. I'm a member of the stakeholders committee. I'm also on the oversight task force. And the interest groups are the Retail Task Force and International Council of Shopping Centers, so it's a retail focus. Let me add just a few comments to Bob's statements, and I concur with most of them. We've done a lot of good work. The focus has been to create this better balance, sort of simple way of looking at it. The access management needs of the highway are certainly important, but what we thought needed to come into a higher balance with more focus were the economic development needs of the adjacent properties. And so that's the interest that I'm furthering as we discuss these issues. In terms of the three things that we're bringing forward to you in the 2013 session, the first one, Bob mentioned, on unpermitted driveways is really a holdover from the prior work. And when we did all the change of use, the new rules to make it more streamlined for businesses that are there and want to redevelop or, add a little bit, we did it with the idea that most of the driveways in the state were already permitted. When we finished the work, we were told by ODOT that, about 60 to 80% of them don't have permits. So the whole system that we had just created was created to, on the assumption that you had permitted driveways. Well, over the years, for a variety of reasons, as your memo points out, those permits haven't been issued, but I think the bulk of them in the urban area are simply driveways that were built or allowed to remain open by ODOT during projects that didn't get permitted. So when you come in as a property owner to change, the first thing you hear is, you know, you've got an illegal driveway there and you can't do anything. And then you engage in about 6 months of argument about whether the driveway was built by the department or by somebody, you know, Saturday night with no permission from the department at all. So it's created this huge, you know, bottleneck. You can't even get into the door and get started on your conversation because the paperwork doesn't exist. Or if it does, it's all behind ODOT's doors. So they have all that information. So we are coming up, hopefully, with a solution to that problem that doesn't require a lot of work. I mean, there have been suggestions that we go back and repermit all these driveways. We don't have the money or the time to do that. It wouldn't provide any value. So we're trying to come up with something that's self-effecting, that's fair and simple, and doesn't cost a lot of money, and allows us to go forward and not look back, at least in a big way. So that's on the unpermitteds, and we've got some good ideas on how to do that. The other two are new and carry this better balance notion forward in two other important contexts. So, you know, we've spent a lot of time on what it takes and what should be fair in getting access to the highway. And so we build a building and develop a use and begin operating, and then the highway project comes along and seeks to take away the driveways that we just convinced the highway department that we needed for economic development purposes and that are safe. So the project then comes along with a different focus and says, well, you don't meet standards. We're here to modernize, and we want to close some of your driveways that we just permitted. Now, that's an example, not always the case, but it's an example of this sort of conflict between what's important in permitting and this new idea that we give more credence to the economic development needs of these local businesses. These are mom and pops in majority part, but there's a lot of them. And so a lot of economic juice is at stake on the businesses that are adjacent to these highways. So how do we provide better protection for them when the highway department wants to spend the state money to improve the highway? Well, we've just agreed, even though we've reduced the standards to make them more reasonable, there's still a high likelihood that, you know, most properties aren't going to meet the highway standards for spacing. So it's easy to come along in a project and say, well, we need to close you out because you don't meet standards. We just went through that discussion in the permitting and agreed that that wasn't the right test. So we're looking for how to import this concept of the better balance of these needs, respective needs, in the project delivery context. And that's going to talk about safety issues and, you know, plopping medians down in the middle of highways. I mean, I'm sure you've all heard from your constituents that, you know, medians are effective to control turning movements, but they're also not favored by local businesses because it doesn't allow their customers easy access to their sites. And so in most of the highway settings, you want to have one turn movement to get into your site. You don't want to have to turn on a side street and go to the back street and then turn to the into the site. I mean, that destroys businesses. It really does. So it's how to get, again, this balance in the context of, and we know it's important, the department's there to spend the money of the state to improve the highway, and it's the steward of the system. So we recognize fully that that's a big responsibility, and we're all paying for it. So don't misunderstand us. We're not suggesting that that isn't important. But again, what hasn't been given its due are the economic development needs of those adjacent properties in a project delivery context. So that's what we're going to work on this time as well. The third thing is the interchange area management planning effort. Now that's tied to projects. For an interchange area, it would be the precursor. So it sets the stage for what's going to happen in a project in an interchange area. So same principles come into being. I mean, most of our interchanges that we're concerned with are in urban communities. They're built environments. And so you retrofit this new interchange area planning set of dynamics over the top of it, and it doesn't work very well. The thing that popped up out of the IAMPS, as they're called, is the 1,320-foot rule. That was one of the tools in the planning box that was really focused to the exclusion of everything else. And what it says is you've got a quarter mile of a no-build zone around extended from the furthest ends of your interchange ramps. That's a huge area. If you take, you know, all of those interchanges, over 300 of them in urban areas, well, I'm not sure. The state has over 300 interchanges. How many in urban areas? I'm guessing. But you have a significant number of interchanges in urban areas, and if that no-build zone were actually affected, then you have a big inconsistency between, you know, the land use planning policy of the state is to grow up, not out, make things more intensify use and development inside growth boundaries. So if you can't use all of that area, then you're going to have to move the boundary. Well, or it just doesn't work to close those driveways. So ODOT readily admits, and we've had very good feedback from them, that the sort of myopic look at that rule was not intended in terms of the 1,320 feet. It was supposed to be a tool, but, you know, it's an easy thing to focus on, and it's been focused on probably to the exclusion of some of the other work. So that's the focus of the work this time, is how to massage that rule in terms of that measuring point, but also how to give the private property owners equal role in determining what their future access rights would be in this planning endeavor. So probably gone on too far, but that's more of a detailed flavor of some of the issues in these three areas that we're going to bring back to you this coming session.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If we could move back to your second point for just a second, Mr. Willow. You were talking about, generally speaking, the shopping center median access point. Usually those issues don't hit our desk until there's a major problem. In Southern Oregon, I can think of Crater Lake Highway. In Woodburn, I can think of the old Walmart site. And the list goes on and on. Is this getting ironed out? Are we still, I mean, is there going to be a comprehensive way of working between business and the department so that those issues don't reach the legislature? It seems to me, in my experience, it takes about 3 or 4 years to iron those things out. Is it going to get fixed before it gets to us?
Well, actually, that Senator, thank you for the question. And we're trying. Actually, the median problem was the first thing that popped up on the screen that led to Senate Bill 1024. We didn't solve it in that with the change of use. We didn't actually get to it in 264 in the permitting context. We did it only in the permitting context, but I think most of your medians you're going to see are going to be in this project delivery context. So that's where, you know, that's where we're going to try to take you off the hot seat, if you would, by solving, coming up with that better balance and not using medians, not go to the extreme out of the box. And that's, I guess, an easy way for us to say it. I mean, medians certainly are effective, and they do have an application that's appropriate in many circumstances. But what we observe is that the department will go to a median treatment as the first solution and not the last one. So in the permitting context, we set it up so that it would be a mitigation measure of last choice. You would have to establish the fact that nothing else would work before you could go to something that actually does work, but also has those harsh impacts on the adjacent properties in terms of their local access. So how to balance that in the project delivery context is before us this time.
Let me ask a question of both of you. What role does if we talk about medians and you talk about access, what role does aesthetics have to do with this planning? And the reason I say that is being a devoted Oregonian, I know the difference between Lancaster Highway aesthetically in Salem and some other areas that are considerably more beautiful in their layout. What does aesthetics play a role in this at all?
I would say I think the aesthetics are an outcome of the collaborative work that we do with local governments on planning communities and developing infrastructure like boulevards or routes that serve different parts of our community. And so it's not, it doesn't drive decisions around access so much. It doesn't drive the development planning processes so much, but it's certainly an important outcome, I think, for communities to think about what their the livability aspect and the aesthetic aspect of their land use planning and how the transportation system, road system, and access as an element of that plays into that. So there's lots of examples that we could point to or communities could point to and say, you know, we certainly wouldn't favor that in our community. But I think it's more around the land use planning, and it just emphasizes the importance of the process that we've outlined and that we have available to us to work with stakeholders and communities and the department to come up with a plan that serves those properties, but does it in such a way that you know, we're not creating a hazard. We're maintaining safety and operations on the transportation system itself, but also focusing on the livability aspect for communities.
Mr. Chair, Senator, in response, the work doesn't directly affect the aesthetic issue. We're not dealing with visibility or design treatments or any of that that would typically come from your local ordinances, placement of buildings, landscaping, those types of things. I mean, they're all important to us, and we all want to have facilities that are attractive, but that's not part of directly the work that we're doing here.
Chair Byer, Senator Atkinson, I would just quickly add to Mark's remarks to your first comment as well, and that I think we put the process in place. We certainly have... we understand the importance and have shifted to balancing traffic operations and safety on the system differently than how we've looked at it in the past and looking at the economic development opportunities. And we've got a process in place for working with stakeholders and local communities. But it's not to say that, you know, we're going to satisfy a landowner in every situation. I mean, I think everyone recognizes that safety, traffic safety and operations is paramount. It's important for different types of highways, different types of routes. You mentioned one, Lancaster. There's, you know, if you look at the other extreme where you've got higher speed type facilities, no one wants to create an unsafe situation. So there may be decisions that are unfavorable to the landowner simply to ensure that we are upholding the responsibility to look first at traffic safety and operations and how we balance that. So it's not to say that there, you know, we're not going to get to yes every time, but I think we certainly put the process, we've created a better process for looking at how we balance those things.
Thanks. I have one other question, Mr. Chair. I guess a comment first. I wish aesthetics could, I know that's not part of your work, and I know there's a bunch of folks here from ODOT. I wish that could be a higher priority just because the amount of time and planning that we put into projects and then it gets done, and I think it plays to everyone's fear of land use planning not working and at the same time having strip malls. Nothing against strip malls, but a tree here and there actually is kind of how we like to see it in Oregon. And there's a lot of examples of new construction that, frankly, the aesthetics look not good. Maybe that's a output of a committee or a task force. But, Mr. Whitlow, I have one other question for you. You and I don't believe, have had the pleasure to meet, but you have been given a pre-copy of a film that's going to be debuted in the Cannes Film Festival called Sidetracked for Father's Day. I believe you've reviewed this film, and I'd like to have a your opinion of the film.
Senator Barr, Senator Atkinson, yes, indeed, I have in fact had the pleasure, the great pleasure of viewing that film, and it is, I think, you know, it's an award winner in my estimate, so fish on would be another way to say it. So
much for the commercial.
Fine piece.
It's a great commercial.
And I do look forward to meeting you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for the work you're doing. We're hearing much more positive comments, and I know it's not easy, and I suspect that the clients that Mark has probably don't create the aesthetic issues you're talking about.
We hope not.
They got deeper pockets than some of the other ones. But
exactly.
I know about the median thing, 126, which runs through where I live. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a competing interest of people, merchants wanting access to the doors and counting bodies. We've killed a lot of people along there. So.
But our point, and let me just say this, is that we agree with the safety issue. We're not proposing driveways over safety in any circumstance. But our comments to you last year and the year before were that we think safety has been overly exercised as a concern. So we're not suggesting that, you know, we permit driveways that are unsafe, but we do think that a lot of driveways haven't been permitted that would have been safe. And so that's what we're trying to do, is get that balance right.
Keep working at it.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. Next up, more information on the transportation planning rule in Oregon Highway. So, Matt?
Good morning, Chair Beyer. Matt Krall here on the staff at the Department of Land Conservation Development. To report to you guys this morning a little bit about the transportation planning rule. And with me?
For the record, I'm Eric Kovig, the planning section manager with the Oregon Department of Transportation.
To talk about the Oregon Highway Plan and, of course, how those two are intricately related. So what I'd like to do this morning is hit 3 points, just do a little bit of background on the TPR, because I know that you don't actually live with it every day the way I do, so it's always good to kind of frame that up a little bit. Talk briefly about the amendments, outline them, or go into as much detail as folks would like to, and then talk a little bit about the outcomes we've seen since those amendments last December. So in terms of background, it's always good to remember that the Transportation Planning Rule is adopted by the Land Conservation and Development Commission to support these statewide planning goals. Don't let the word transportation fool you there. It's as much about land use planning and the integration of that as it is transportation. The transportation planning rules actually are about a dozen rules, most of which deal with the process of how to develop transportation system plans. It's that proactive planning that we do ahead of time. And most of those are not very controversial. But the one that we're here to talk about today is TPR 060, the one that does get a lot of attention, because it deals with that situation where a city is amending their land use plans. Typically, they're rezoning. And that raises the issues. In broadest terms, what TPR 060 says is consistency. When you're making amendments to your zoning or your land use, those ought to be consistent with your land use plans. And when you stay at that broad level, it sounds like, well, who can argue against consistency? Who's going to stand up and say, I want some contradictory planning in my community, please? But, of course, it's not that simple. And we have heard concerns about unintended consequences and the way that works in the details. But I think two things to note about the TPR before we get into those. One is that it does not cover the actual permit process. When you're going to get a building permit or a site plan review, it's at that rezoning level. And sometimes we hear about concerns happening for areas that are already zoned for it permitted. That's usually because of local regulations. And so that needs to be addressed at the local level. And we can work with them, but that's not really a TPR issue. And the second is that the performance standards that we use to measure that consistency are not written straight into the TPR. It's something that local communities define for their local network. They define how to measure it, and they define what is that threshold over which it's unacceptable. And then, of course, on the state system, which is very important, it's defined through the Oregon Highway Plan how to measure performance and what is that acceptable threshold. Despite that, we did hear about some unintended consequences over the last couple years. We were hearing a lot about concerns that in some cases the TPR makes economic development more difficult. That certainly is not the intent. And heard that it makes it very difficult, or can make it difficult to have more compact development in downtown areas. If you're trying to increase those intensities, you may end up failing some of those performance standards. But yet, intensity downtown is what a lot of the land use planning system is built on. So that was an unintended consequence. The result of that was there was a joint subcommittee set up with OTC members and LCDC members to talk about that, because we really can't talk about them separately. They came up with a list of issues to address. This committee took a look at that list and said, yeah, that's a really good idea. In fact, we'll give you a piece of legislation that says go do that. And so we got that, and we got it and made those amendments last December at both LCDC to the TPR and OTC to the OHP. Since then, we've been going out and trying to do some outreach to let everybody know what has happened. And so I'll just give a quick list of some of the places that we've been to over the last, what is this now, 9 months? In February, went to the Oregon State Bar, their local government section, to do some continuing legal ed. March was a busy month for us. We went to the Association of Oregon County Planning Directors. We went to the Regional Solution Coordinators through the governor's office. We did a big several-hour presentation. We used some facilities at PSU to do that so folks from Portland could attend, but then we were also webcasting that statewide, and it is still available online. We did a meeting in Bend of the governor's regulatory streamlining regional meeting. In May, we went to the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association, their annual conference. In June, this was actually not state staff that did this one, but Ed Sullivan did a presentation at his Euclid Society talking about these changes, because attorneys are very interested in these as well. In August, I was down in Eugene for their Chamber of Commerce to talk to them about that. But today, while we're here, down in Eugene at the Oregon Planning Institute, some of our colleagues are presenting this very same material to planners from across the state, get together at that annual conference. And coming up on the 24th, we'll be up in Metro talking, doing a seminar there, talking about how their regional plans fit with all of this. So that's the background. As far as the amendments themselves, I've given you a handout, and I know that we're a little short on time here, so I guess my question is, do you want me to step through those in an outline format or just take questions on them?
Well, let's see. People have questions. I mean, it's actually been pretty early. We did cover it a little bit in the last February session. So
whatever your pleasure is. I can step through those 6 points in an outline or take questions. And
I guess I'm more interested. It's probably too early to tell, but what kind of feedback are you getting?
The outcomes? Sure. We'll jump right to that then, if that's what would be of interest. So I certainly had hoped to be able to report to you some successes by now, that we would have some things done. It has not been as much as I would have liked. That's partly it is less than a year since adoption, and land development is still moving very slowly at this point. But I will say we're not hearing the kind of concerns or complaints that in the past. So I think that at least is positive. And there are several local governments that are in the process of making use of this. Just last week, we received a submittal from Lake Oswego. They want to use one of the new sections there to designate what's known as a multimodal mixed-use area in their downtown and the Foothills district. And once they've gone through that process, congestion standards would not apply in that area as they look at future development. Because again, in a downtown area, that's what you expect, and you expect to have intense development there. We've heard a number of other cities who are interested in that, but Lake Oswego has been the first one to actually submit something to us. To make that a little easier for folks, one of the things that is being presented down in Eugene this morning is we have prepared a set of sample findings. And we took a fictional city of Planwell and said, if Planwell were to adopt a multimodal mixed-use area, here are the kind of findings that they could use to do that. So we hope that that'll make it easier for other cities to plug right into that template and do that. In terms of the partial mitigation for economic development, that was another one of the new sections we add. We do not have any actual submittals to us yet, but we are in pre-application meetings on a property up near the Portland Airport. It is, I believe it's called the Colwood National Golf Club. Of course, they are being bought by a land trust, and they're interested in taking about 40 acres and converting it from golf course to industrial. And then the rest of it, I believe, is going to end up as some sort of an open space. So we have a pre-application meeting with them next week, and it seems to be moving along. Another section that was added was to smooth the path when somebody's making an amendment that is consistent with their comprehensive plan and consistent with their TSP, and we have had a couple of relatively minor come through on that. So that's what we know about outcomes so far. I take any other questions? Or
Senator Girard? Yeah, I listen to this, and I represent rural cities. I have 18 cities. And you talked a little bit about how you want one set of rules to fit all. And I think that's a fundamental flaw in your department, because what's good in Scio, Oregon might not work in Portland. What's good in Portland might not work in Scio. And we need development out in the rural areas. We've been hurting for a long time. So I really feel very strongly that we need to start looking at regionalization of your division, because it really, truly, one set of rules does not fit all in the state. We are totally different, and our needs are totally different. And we just keep going that we wanted the same ruling to have the same impact, the same set of circumstances, but you can't duplicate the differences between one city and the next. And so I think there needs to be a lot more flexibility in land use, and I do see your agency as holding up development, something fierce. I've done development, and it's not an easy thing to do. So I just wanted to throw that tidbit out.
Let me comment. Fred, I understand where you're coming from. On this one, I think that, because I sat in on most of the work groups that are doing, and there was a good cross-section, in fact, probably dominated by more small cities and rural areas and even the urban areas, and I, including Mr. Whitlow and much of it. I think what they came up with, at least in theory, it didn't make everybody completely happy, but I think it was a good set, and I think they showed the department, both departments, ODOT and DLCD, so great flexibility and change from past practice, given their responsibilities. So we really won't know whether that works or not until the economy picks up and we start seeing some things happening. But I do think that there was a good effort, and the professional folks that were involved who have to deal with that on a day-to-day, on both the private and the municipal side, were pleased with the outcome.
Okay. Senator Beyer, Chair Beyer, Senator Girard, well, thank you for those comments in support of that. Just a couple of thoughts I would share with you. If I suggested that one size should fit all, I apologize. That has certainly not been the intent or what we have done in this. We created, I think, quite a few paths, multiple paths, to get to an approval. And in fact, one of the confusions we've had in a couple of cases is deciding, well, which of the path is it that you're actually using when they've submitted to us? And you could arguably say that's Section 9 or it's Section 1. We don't need to actually argue over that. We say, well, it gets there, but to show that there are a lot of paths. I would also point out that this is a problem that has not really hit rural areas in as well, because congestion is not really the issue in most small towns. They have transportation issues, but it's not because of congestion. And so we did end up in some of these rules probably focusing on a little bit of the bigger cities, because that's where the congestion had really been the issue and held up the development. I think in smaller areas, there it's simply, do we have enough money to maintain the streets? Could we provide some additional connectivity? But it's not that you're backed up at stoplights in those communities that you described.
Let me give you an example.
Certainly.
And that would be the use of bike paths. In rural Oregon, that's not just a priority. You know, I understand it in Portland, where it's very, very popular, or Eugene. But I don't think that, that should be a focus and in some of the requirements that we require in rural Oregon. So we put these roadblocks in. And I think that they're not intended to be roadblocks, but it drives the cost up, and it just makes it that much harder for us to develop in rural Oregon. And if you look at the unemployment rate and you look at how it's dispersed, rural Oregon is really paying a heavy price right now.
All right. Thank you, Chair Beyer. As Matt said, the legislation that you passed contained two components, required changes both to the transportation planning rule, but it also required the Oregon Transportation Commission to make some policy changes to the Oregon Highway Plan around our mobility policy. And the commission did adopt those changes back in December, and we have been implementing those. I'm going to walk through those changes just really briefly. One of the key things we heard was that when jurisdictions and developers want to make a change to their land use plan and it was only going to have a small increase in traffic, that it was getting held up in a very bureaucratic, lengthy process. We've changed our policy and modified our policy to allow some of those small increases in traffic to be essentially exempted from that longer, more detailed process. We put some conditions on what kind of roadways, how much traffic does that make sense. We've provided some more flexibility so we can work with local governments to try to figure out where that those opportunities are. We've really modified just the policy context about what are we trying to achieve. You heard earlier from Bob Bryant with ODOT and Mark Whitlow about trying to balance economic development objectives with mobility and safety. We brought that same kind of mindset into the mobility policy as well, that we need to be very inclusive and thoughtful about how we're thinking about mobility, community design, multiple goals and objectives as we're trying to plan out transportation systems and think about mobility in broader terms and contexts. Another big change we made is just changing our terminology. Mobility has been viewed as this hard and fast standard, so we actually changed it to a mobility target, where it's more of a conversation that we have with local governments and stakeholders about how can the system perform, and it's more of an outcome as a negotiated conversation with local governments and stakeholders about what can we afford, how can the system be built and managed over time. So it tries to change and flip the paradigm of the conversation, changing from a hard and fast standard to a target. And then we really talk about some of the detailed changes around thinking about how we establish alternate mobility targets to think different kinds of measures, what are the values of a community, thinking in broader terms of just a highway segment to a longer corridor to an area, trying to expand some of the things in the toolbox, make it more explicit in our policies, what can we really achieve in partnership with our local government partners. And then the last change we made is looking back at the Oregon Highway Plan, which was written back in 1999, we realized that traffic conditions have changed over time, and we needed to look at maybe those targets in the Oregon Highway Plan in urban areas. So we actually raised the mobility target to say we can allow higher levels of congestion, because that's what we're really experiencing in many of our urban environments, to bring it more into reality of what we're seeing today as projecting into the future as well. So trying to recognize that the world changes over a 12, 13-year period. Into the results section, I share Matt's exact message. We haven't had a lot of use of the new tools yet. I think a lot of that is still with the economic conditions. Development is still kind of slow getting back up into where it needs to be. But we are starting to see some jurisdictions make use of the tools, both in the TPR side, but also in the Oregon Highway Plan side. For example, we've had a couple communities use the small increase in traffic provisions out of the Oregon Highway Plan. This has been done up in Scappoose and Sutherland, and a few other jurisdictions are starting to look into the opportunity to use that. We're working with a lot of communities about how to establish what is the mobility expectations for your community overall. We have work going on in Astoria, Ashland, Newport, looking in the Portland metro area at some of their corridors, Sandy, and we're really trying to build off some of the successes we had up on the North Coast with the community in Seaside about how do we have these conversations and balance mobility, economic development, system, and all the objectives that communities have. We're also working over in Central Oregon to look at a corridor approach on US 97 to start thinking about mobility in broader context over there. While we're not having a whole lot of application come in, I think what we're really seeing in the department is the cultural shift that Bob was talking about, trying to have these more balanced, open conversations where all these factors are brought onto the table and we're making joint decisions and expectations and setting those together with our partners. What I'm finding is when we work in partnership with that kind of collaborative approach, we're finding solutions can be obtained. Matt also mentioned on the TPR side, there was a lot of different changes. One of the tools we're finding is somebody may be coming in saying, we want to make use of this particular provision, but we may actually find there's another provision of the TPR or the Oregon Highway Plan that helps them get there just as easy or even easier. So trying to help local developers and communities find the easiest and best path to trying to achieve their goals and objectives. That's one of the great things about the changes is I think it allows multiple pathways and multiple options to help us get there. An example of this is actually down in the Goshen area and in Chair Byers' area, working with the county on how they're working towards a land use change from rural industrial to more urban scale industrial. We've helped them find various pathways through through the system. We think we found the best approach there. So bottom line, I think what we're seeing is not a lot of formal applications, but we are starting to see a lot of jurisdictions and developers come to us asking questions. They're actually wanting to do the work ahead of time to make sure they have everything lined up before submitting their application. Colwood, I think, is an example. We've had a few other examples where they've come in wanting to try to make sure they understand how this is going to flow through, get everything lined up so the land use process is as streamlined as possible. So I think we are seeing some changes. We're definitely seeing some changes in how ODOT is working with our local partners. In over 9 months, that's what we've seen so far. But we're looking forward to how it'll progress into the future.
Questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, well, we're done with transportation for the day. Now we're going to move into liquor control. Mr. Farrell, I see you here, and I see your chairs here as well. And it looks like you got a lot of people.
Chair Byer, committee members, for the record, I'm Steve Farrell, Director of the Liquor Commission. This is Tom Irwin. You want to go ahead and introduce?
Yeah, I'm Tom Irwin. I'm Government Affairs and Communications Director for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and with the chair and the committee's indulgence, I'd also like to introduce some special guests in the audience. With Chair Cass Skinner-Lapata, we also have Pat Kohler, the administrator from the Washington State Liquor Control Board, and Rick Garza, the Deputy Administrator from the Washington State Liquor Control Board. So okay. I wanted to make sure people knew that they were in the audience. And if, I'm sure, I don't know how willing they're wanting to come up here to talk to you, but if you do have some questions, I'm sure they're more than willing to. And I'm going to try to just open our slideshow here.
Let me just preface this a little bit. I ask the Commission to come and report to us just to give us an idea of what's going on with obviously the Washington's change there and sort of to our benefit to some extent, but I think the change to retail in Washington probably mirrors some interests that the citizens have, although it's obvious to me that the people of Washington thought they were going to get cheaper prices, which apparently did not happen. But and I know that the Commission over the last couple of years has been moving innovatively to try and make more options available to the community. So I'm just sort of interested in your reaction to what's happening by across the state line, and what's the Commission doing to try and address that, address what at least I perceive as citizens' desires in this state.
Chair Byer, committee members, that's what we're here to go ahead and talk about.
Great.
Today. I appreciate the opportunity. Certainly there has been no little controversy with regards to the privatization within Washington State. I think there were a lot of challenges that are before both us and Washington with regards to those changes. Let's go ahead and go to the changes. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the changes. Essentially, it took Washington State out of the liquor business and moved it to private enterprise at that point. There are certain parts of the initiative that talk about certain taxes or fees that are supposed to be put in. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that, but really relate more to how it's affected us or the impact to us and what we are doing in order to modernize and continue to modernize. So one of the first things I just wanted to go ahead and comment on is we did some comparison snapshots for pricing, and you can see the difference in price is pretty significant. Now, to be fair, our prices were generally lower than Washington's to begin with. However, certainly the passage of 1183 and the requirements within 1183 have exacerbated that to the point where there's certainly a significant difference.
Real quick question, Mr. Chair.
For those of us that don't know all the details of the Washington initiative that was passed, was there a significant tax increase included with the legislation a liquor tax increase or not, or what?
I think I've got a chair buyer, Senator Edwards. Yes, there were certainly fees or taxes that were included in the initiative as it was written. The one that comes to mind is what most people talk about is the additional 17% that was layered on top.
Is that what it was, 17%?
Was it a gross receipts? Was it a gross receipts tax? Is that the way they did it? And it was it essentially the concept, I think, as I heard it, was the way it was sold is it would be revenue neutral to the state treasury?
And Senator Beyer, I think that's really the way it was sort of targeted. Did you want to make any comments, sir?
Only that the 10% distributor fee and the 17% retail fee is an annual gross sales fee. That was to generate additional revenue than what the state was generating when it was in the business. Okay. So it was a revenue enhancement overall.
Right, Chair Byron, committee members, that was the drive in order to be revenue neutral for the state as far as the dollars that come into the state.
We're replacing what we would consider a markup, business markup in our side, with a tax.
Chair Byron, essentially, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And thank you. Just we'll quickly go through the comparisons. There certainly is a significance. That's been the talk of many people, the difference in pricing. There's no doubt that that makes a difference. We are certainly seeing a bump in business, I believe, because of that. But once again, the prices were generally, our prices were generally lower than Washington's to begin with. One of the things, though, that I think that I do want to emphasize with regards to the Oregon system is there's certainly a significant selection that we carry out there for our customers. And the population in terms of those who buy distilled spirits have changed over the years, and there is certainly a much greater interest, just as wines sort of got very eclectic and with a broad range of opportunities, so too happens with distilled spirits. So at any given time, we probably have about 1,900 items available within our distribution center, and in many of the stores, it'll carry between 1,200 and 1,700 items available. Then we have many, many items that are also available by special order. So one of the things that we focus on is taking care of the customers in terms of the opportunity to get the products they want. That will somewhat be challenged within the Washington state, because generally the way the big operations work within stores is they only carry about 350 items. So generally those are the faster movers. We certainly will carry those in our store, but then a much greater depth of specialized products also.
So is that really the difference, 350 average in now in the Washington stores versus 1,900 in all of, is it in all of the OLCCs?
Chair Beyer, we have generally 1,900 available. They will generally run between 1,200 items and 1,700 items available in most stores. So maybe not every item is available in every store, because you don't, if it doesn't sell in that area, you don't certainly want to carry a certain item. So there's, it's up to the agents that we have in order to select those items. That's but generally, the larger corporate entities that are grocery stores certainly have a challenge before them because they have limited space. Mm-hmm. So generally what our survey showed, there was about 350 items, and those would generally be the fast movers.
How many in Costco?
I think the numbers are closer to 60 to 70, and those generally are the half gallons.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And just a brief look at, since 1183, how sales have been affected with regards to Oregon, it is in fact pretty staggering, the difference in terms of some sales, especially certainly along the border. There is a significant increase in terms of sales than what we have been. I do want to preface, though, that originally when we started out the biennium, we were looking at sales, what we thought would grow at about a 3.2% average. We were already running about 4.5% to 5.5% to 6% average. So the market was already beginning to increase in terms of sales to begin with, but certainly 1183 has probably prompted even a greater acceleration in that process.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to go ahead and spend a lot of time on charts. There's a lot of green. There's a lot of growth in comparison to where we were before. I did want to take a moment. Let's go ahead and move to the bottle. So everyone can get a perspective of the revenues that come in. So we did an average price on our products of $15.51. And I want to make it clear that you can see from how we've broken this down, the bulk of what it, bulk of what's there goes to the manufacturer. We certainly have to pay for the product that we carry. $1.39 is on average of that bottle price would be going to the agents that make our sales out there, and about 80 cents goes for operating expenses for the OLCC. That covers all operating expenses for OLCC, including all the regulatory licensing, et cetera. And 37% goes back to general fund, cities, and counties. The revenue source in the pie chart there, certainly you can see distilled spirits is the major contributor for our revenue sources. We broke down for 2009-2011, $350 million. I'm not going to go through all the numbers there, but certainly once again it clearly indicates how much is coming in. This is a chart that I think is pretty telling. If you take a look back over the last almost 10 years, there is a continuous increase in terms of where sales have gone in terms of revenue. Now, there is certainly more bottles being sold, but of the bottles that we are selling, we are also seeing a move up to premium products that are being purchased, which means for dollar, you may have a few less products that are bought, but you're making more money for the state because those products are more expensive. The marketplace has changed significantly over the last 10, 15 years to where the general fast movers are still there, like the Jack Daniels and the Jim Beam, et cetera. But there are many, many upscale products now that are coming in the marketplace, and that has certainly contributed to that trend line in terms of revenue.
Senator Edwards has a question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's relevant to this. Back to this slide, you don't have to go back to it, but the 1581 bottle price.
1551.
Or 1551. Was that an average bottle?
Average bottle.
Okay. That's always one.
You don't have that comparison to what the pricing has done in Washington. I guess the difference is you probably have the what we would consider our markup, and then on top of that you have distribution and profit to the private operators. I assume Washington isn't flooring the products in the warehouse anymore.
No, they're not.
So you've got all of that. You introduced the warehousing and distribution into the system up there.
Senator Beyer, committee members, their warehousing is all private at this point.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. You introduced that. The difference in pricing is you put that in, and it's just it's a cost to somebody, and both levels are both the retail and the distributors trying to make a profit.
That's correct, Senator Beyer. Somebody's got to make a profit on the deal. But you can see from that trend line, there's certainly a good trend line for revenue growth. I wanted to go over, we have, from the start of the biennium, I mentioned we were looking at about 3.2% growth, and now certainly it's substantially more. Originally, we projected about $920 million in sales for the system over the biennium, and now that has moved up to $980 million. So ultimately, there will be an additional distribution of about $24 million that will come into the state. $13.5 million approximately will be going into the general fund. One of the other key things that is happening within the Oregon system is the very quick growth in terms of craft distilleries, where you certainly dealt with major distilleries that were in the marketplace. Oregon has sort of moved along with its craft breweries and wineries, is now being a center of craft distilleries that are also growing at a pretty good rate. So you're finding that the sales for those are certainly going up. Very premium products and very well received within the marketplace. And these are just a couple quotes that talk about the fact that, that it is truly local handcrafted. There is certainly a greater interest in terms of what is done locally than what there were 5-10 years ago, and that is being shown in the marketplace to be very profitable.
Do you happen to know, do these products, Oregon products, are they widely distributed or are they just mostly in Oregon?
Senator Beyer, one of the things that we are very pleased with in our system is we make sure that they are readily available throughout the state. Now, as far as national distribution, that I can't really comment on, but certainly one of the things that our system does provide is ready opportunities to get them into the marketplace out there, mm-hmm. which is very critical for these craft distilleries when they get started up. Mm-hmm. And you can see the locations out there. 43 licensed distilleries, 300 products, and I would urge, if you get a chance, to go into one of our liquor stores and take a look at the growth of those Oregon products, because it is very significant. And I once again want to stress that they're very, very well received and excellent products. One of the key factors also we provide is that many times, as the wineries can provide tastings and provide sales, we also provide the opportunity for a number of our distillers out there to actually sell the products at their location. Currently, 29 have applied for and actually can sell their products right at their distillery. We continue to expand the number of stores that are available due to the population growth and the changes in demographics. Three new stores that we're looking at now, another location in Portland area in terms of the West, Damascus, and also around Portland Cascade Station up by the airport. And we will continue to monitor and grow as it dictates in the marketplace. Hey, Senator Barr, you had commented on about perhaps modernization. One of the things that we had embarked upon some time ago, actually over three, now going on 4 years ago, was to discuss the opportunity to change some of the dynamics within the marketplace so that we would create opportunities for our agents to change and profit, as well as create opportunities for corporations also to get into the game. Currently, a corporation, as you might understand it, which would be Target, Safeway, etc., did not really have access to become an agent. It was exclusively individuals that would be able to do that. The commission did go ahead and vote to change that to the opportunity where it would be able to have corporations would be able to have essentially store in a store of their own, and also that agents would be able to sell beer and wine, exclusive agents would be able to sell beer and wine. We currently have two categories of agents now, non-exclusive, which you find in rural Oregon, which tend to be able to sell many different products, and then you have the exclusive agents, which are those that, you know, essentially sell just distilled spirits. So we wanted to create opportunity for those exclusive agents to sell beer and wine, but in doing so, put a business expectation that there would be moves and relocations and improvements in their stores, not only to accommodate that additional sales, but also make it more convenient and better for the customer out there. And we have actually seen that come to fruition in terms of where some of those stores have moved to and the size and what they're offering. And I'll comment on that in just a moment. So we do have the opportunity now for a test project, which we agreed to with certain members of the legislature, to allow for four corporations to become agents for us, and also four stores to convert from exclusive to non-exclusive and sell beer and wine. One of the stores that has currently converted from being an exclusive store is Lincoln City North. That store is significant. That's about 4,000 square feet. And they had a significant opportunity down there, especially for many of the smaller wineries and many of the microbrews to carry within their store, especially for the tourist population as it goes through. So I talked to that agent personally within the last week, and it's very successful. And he's certainly seen it also gives a bump within his distilled spirit sale also.
So what's your intent with that? These are sort of pilots?
These are sort of pilots to go ahead and sort of give everybody an idea.
And if, like this one, they proved to be successful, what's the intent?
Chair by our committee members, the intent would be to go ahead and open up opportunities depending upon the business plan that comes forward. So if there was an agent out there that had an exclusive store and he was two streets back from Main Street and said, I would like to sell beer and wine, he would have to come up with a business plan that would say, okay, I'm going to probably move my store then to Main Street, move from 2,000 square feet to 4,000 square feet. It's going to be more new, modern, a lot of lighting in there, et cetera. So the idea is that by having beer and wine is also additional revenue source, and that additional revenue source will allow him to go ahead and move to a better location, create greater customer convenience.
Mr. Chairman, so your goal is greater, nicer stores, more convenience for customers?
Absolutely.
And to grow the revenue for the agents.
And so that would be a natural outcome.
I haven't followed this topic closely enough, so forgive perhaps the naivete of my question. But what's the interest of the commission in driving a store if they want to add beer and wine? You know, you want to see a business plan, and you want them to maybe relocate, and you want them to have more space. So, I mean, like, I'm trying to, I'm, I'm I'm grappling with what the public interest is in that.
Chair Byers, Senator Edwards, the idea would be is generally those stores that would want to carry the beer and wine are pretty well maxed down in space as far as distilled spirits. So if you allow them without some business plan to go ahead and move to probably a bigger, better location, they would have to cannibalize distilled spirit sale. And so that would be counter to the interests of the consumers that are out there based upon the fact that we do carry a large selection, offer a large selection. So the idea of the additional revenue that they could garner from the beer and wine would also help fundamentally keep distilled spirit sales moving forward, make so those products are available to the customers, but they would also have the beer and wine that's available to change their business aspects a little bit.
I assume we also make more money. The state makes more money off distilled spirits than wine.
Well, I'm sure the committee members that revenue certainly comes into play. I don't know that any of the agents would want to change their business if they didn't think they could get more revenue.
No, I mean a state revenue.
Not
thing,
arguing with that.
Than a profit thing.
Although the wine tax isn't anywhere near as significant as the
that's the point.
Our interest,
no, I know.
Our interest is taking care of the customers out there, and if the customers want to buy more, then we certainly want to accommodate that. So Ben West is another example of one of our stores, a very nice store, about 3,700 square feet. I would urge if you get an opportunity, if you're over in the Bend area, to go to that store. Very nicely done with nice touches to it. He recently put in beer and wine and also being very well received. So I'm quickly going to go through. We continue to go ahead and modernize through relocation, store openings, agent appointments. So the objective of the modernization is certainly improve shopping experience for the customer. More convenient locations, retailers have made store improvements, have seen as much as a 53% increase. So one particular store in general that I can, or in particular that I can think of, on McAdam Avenue, moved from rather obscure, a small location to a larger location, and sales grew at a 53% rate. And so we can see, and this is what we've demonstrated to or shown to many of our agents, that if they make the investment, and it's their investment, once again, the state is not making that investment, they're taking the risk, which is important to understand. If they take that risk, generally that risk pays off very handsomely for them and for the state. Simple relocations, as in Klamath Falls with the East Klamath Falls store, demonstrate that the stores continue to improve, nicer, larger, brighter. Meeting the customer's expectation is clearly where we're trying to push this whole process. Portland McAdam, as I commented just a moment ago, was moved to a more convenient location. The store is just an excellent outstanding store. Great selection for its customers. Rose City Liquor, you can see the before and after sign there in terms of how that has changed. Menlo Park is another store. We continue to see, and I want to really stress that the agents are most often driving this in their interest to meet the consumer demand and do the things they need to do to grow their business. And in doing so, when they make these changes and these improvements, they're raising the bar for the entire system. Because if you find one agent that does that, many times when they see the increase in revenue that that agent gets, that their neighbor agents begin quickly moving in the same direction. So it's a chain reaction that we're seeing that's very profitable and very beneficial for the customer. Lake Grove, Redmond North, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these. Medford North, as I said. We also have embarked upon some other sort of innovative processes that we've got in terms of liquor stores. Putting liquor stores in seasonal or special areas. For instance, if you ever get over to Sun River, you'll see that there's been a remodeled liquor store within the main grocery store at Sun River. They did an excellent job. Also, Sun River North, which is a smaller location, they have now put a liquor store in there to meet the seasonal needs. Those of you that are down around the Klamath Falls area, you might stop in at the Running Y Ranch. While it may not seem significant, if you get a chance to go in there, they have an outstanding selection of products there to meet the needs, even though it's localized. But it's one of the things that we find is sometimes you have to sort of change the process a little bit and look in these special areas that can make a difference for everybody. We have also been working with Portland, the Port of Portland, with regards to the Portland Airport about having a liquor section out there that is just Oregon products. So you have the Oregon store out there, and so we would be wanting to work with them or anyone else out there that might be willing to carry just Oregon products. Because if you think about it, prior to the 9/11 and all the security issues, if you wanted to buy a bottle someplace and sort of carry it on the plane, you could. Now you'd have to go ahead and pack it in your luggage because you can't take it through the security, and certainly not many people want to take the risk of having a bottle of scotch break in their luggage. So with what we're looking at here, you'd be able, just as you would with wines, go through security and make a purchase, take it on the plane, providing that it's okay to take it back to that state.
That's a good idea, mm-hmm. for the record.
We do have a couple stores within a stores. They have been working very well, and we would encourage other large grocers to take a look at these. It's a real opportunity. Garden Home Lamb's Thriftway was our first location of store within a store. And I will tell you that with regards to the operation of that store within a store, there was a lot of angst by the beer and wine folks that when you put a distillery or distilled spirit store in there, that those sales were going to be suffering. And in fact, what happened was is sales for both the beer and wine actually went up. So it became a destination. So we saw that very successful. And that is also part of what we're trying to do with the idea of corporations being able to get into the game now in terms of competing for agencies.
Steve,
Bethany's the same way.
I have a question. Why the store within the store? I mean, when I go south to California and Nevada, it's just right there in the middle of the Safeway aisle. Why does it have to be in a separate place in the store?
Share buyers, at this point, it is still an agency store. In other words, the corporation would not be actually just, we're not selling it to the corporation. It's still an agency store, but we would allow them to run that store within their area. That's why it has to be separated out, because it's a separate store.
That doesn't make sense.
It's also public safety reasons?
Well, there's certainly public safety reasons. Part of the position of the commission is putting it on the shelf may not be the best idea out there.
Yeah, but I mean, there are certainly a bunch of other states that do that, and they don't seem to have any more problem than we do. And I understand controlling the product, because right. Essentially they get a commission on what's sold, and I'm assuming you have some pilferage issues with the agent stores and some breakage. But
not very much, Senator. But that the idea would be also not only the public safety, but also at this point we still have the mechanism where it is a state.
Has the commission had much discussion about that at all?
It probably would in the future as more corporations perhaps would come into the game.
Well, but that might be a restriction why you don't have a lot of them interested, because they have to make those special accommodations.
Could be.
That's one that I think the chair that your commission ought to talk about, at least.
We can certainly take that to the commission. Sun River South, and that's all the are there any questions with regard to the retail or sales?
Well, that really, I mean, it really does. It looks like you're trying to improve things through the agent system, and I understand that, but I think the real push probably in Washington State was twofold. One was convenience, and the other one was price. Price didn't work for them, although for whatever reason, I suspect it's a difference in taxes. It certainly works in California, as yeah. Senator Atkinson keeps telling me about, he's paying half prices down there.
I'm buying it for you.
Well, if you are, you haven't delivered it. But I assume that's all a matter of taxes.
You mean the difference in prices?
Yeah.
Well, certainly, to some degree, there may be minimum taxes that are required in the Washington State, but there also is a certain amount of profit in which we don't know what their margins are, what they would choose to go ahead and make.
Well, I get that, but you have the same thing on the south border. And
California.
You've got, and right on the border, I don't see them any farther south than the border. You have those stores that are substantial markdowns, and I assume they're dealing a volume deal, but
well, Chair Beyer,
I don't know what the California tax structure is.
Chair Beyer, committee members, we would be happy to provide you with a survey that we did. While on the border, it may be very specific in terms of trying to get certain business aspects in terms of getting Oregonians to buy. When we did a survey across all of California, in many, many cases, we found we were very competitive in terms of our pricing.
Steve, I don't disagree with you. I've done that pricing
okay.
just out of interest. And if you go into the grocery stores in San Francisco or L.A. or even the liquor stores there, you see prices that are very comparable to Oregon's. But there are the discount dealers that are right on the border that are doing high volume.
It's true. Are there any questions with
regard? I don't know how they do that, other than it's just huge volume, I suppose, and the Costco's. But there's, like you say, they have very limited selection of what they offer.
Well, Chair Byer and committee members, we also took a look at some of those prices, and to be sure, many of those items are just discounted down lower than our prices. We also took a look further into those categories in some cases, and they offset the prices by having higher prices than some of the other items within that category. So it's no different than when the old style of milk, eggs, and butter back of the store and lower prices, and when you were walking down the aisle, if you could go ahead and get a can of soup, the can of soup might be marked up a little bit more in order to go ahead and make up for the difference.
Yeah.
So I just want to check and see if there's any questions.
Chair Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is with the new Washington model, is there licensing that still happens, or can any store get into the business?
Chair Byer, Senator Edwards, no, not any store can get a business. The initiative was very clear in the way it was written in terms of the initial applications and the acceptance. You had to be 10,000 square feet or more in terms of a store. So essentially, large grocery stores would be able to qualify. The board, as I understand it at this point, is going through starting the rule process with regards to the possibility of smaller than 10,000 square feet.
So the old stores then were grandfathered? The
old stores were grandfathered in.
Okay. So it's not, yeah, okay. I mean, I guess my only observation, Mr. Chair, is that while it certainly hasn't been favorable for consumer pricing at this stage, it doesn't seem like it's a perfect market either, and it's also early in the development of it. So I don't have strong opinions one way or the other. I think our current system works fine, but it's an interesting observation, though.
So you obviously have an imbalance. What are you seeing in Washington? I imagine there's some pushback.
I'm sorry, Chair Byer.
All right, is there going to be some changes up there? Trying to get at what is we've got an immediate cash in,
well,
on the border. Is there some movement to change the situation in Washington?
Chair Byer, committee members, I'm sure that the Washington State folks have much more detail than I do on that. But certainly, there's already been talk about trying to change the tax structure that was in the initiative, and looking at breaks for smaller businesses, et cetera. So I'm sure that there will be conversations. The fact that there are big sales on the border probably will be a conversation in their legislature up there.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Senator Rudd.
What's the dollar amount are we looking at for extra revenue into your department?
Chair Byer, Senator Garrod, $24 million.
Right.
So if there's no questions on that, I do have just a very brief overview. You had also asked the current status of, I guess, Central Warehousing Grocery Outlet.
Yeah.
And it's not working? Okay. Well, the current status is that in July 2012, the Court of Appeals issued a decision upholding OLCC's final order, which is essentially saying no central warehousing. However, that has been, at this point, there is a grocery outlet has filed for a petition of reconsideration, which is currently in process now. Should that be granted, that'll certainly change the complexion. If not, I would imagine it would go to the Supreme Court. In the meantime, the injunction is still in place, and Grocery Outlet continues to operate how they have always operated. That's it.
Senator?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I refreshed my memory. The lawsuit, will that just apply to Grocery Outlet situation, or will it apply to the broader central warehousing issue?
Chair Byer, Senator Burdick, certainly while it may apply the lawsuit itself to Grocery Outlet, it has implications for much broader, it has much broader implications.
Well, but by implications, would that mean that central warehousing without any action by the legislature would go into effect if Grocery Outlet prevailed?
Mm-hmm. Offhand, I do not know.
And you said something about an injunction right now. The status quo now is Grocery Outlet is central warehousing?
Chair Byer, Senator Burdick, yes, that's correct. They're still operating the same way they've always operated.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And has there been any problems created by that operation for 20 years?
Chair Beyer, committee members, not to my knowledge.
So I guess the other question is the commission working on any legislation or rules that would fix that, making some accommodations to recognize the obvious?
Chair Beyer, committee members, I assume at this point the commission was waiting for the outcome of the court case. So I think it's fair to say at this point we're certainly wanting to hear how the reconsideration goes. But I can certainly take it back to the chair and commissioners that what's going on now and see if they want to pursue anything.
Mr. Director and Madam Chair, it'd be really good if you guys took this up and found a way to fix it so we don't have to pass another bill
so we
in
don't
January.
Have to deal with it.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair, I just
Senator
make a
Atkinson.
comment for those listening online who don't have the legislative background with what happened on the issue that was just pronounced. I know one of the newer proposed board members is listening, and I just want them to know that the way that this hell that this agency put the legislature through last time this was before had to do with ginning up financial work before a committee, being, in my mind, less than truthful to a committee, and essentially creating so much confusion that the grocery outlet bill certainly didn't stand on its own merits. And I don't want to leave a negative taste in my mouth, but I would hope that the director would take this up the next session and not put the next legislature through the complete mess. You have a hard time convincing me that a business needs to have its business plan checked by an agency. I think your comments are correct to some point, but the fact that California is eating our lunch based on a completely different free market approach, if it comes to Knob Creek or Basil Hayden, I have a very difficult time seeing why in the world we're in this business, and why in the world is it so clouded in secrecy, and why in the world the governor doesn't have any control over an agency. But I say that by way of comment for the next legislature and for the next group that's going to be being on the next task force.
Senator, I certainly understand why the state of Oregon is in the liquor business. I think we've seen the numbers. Yeah. And service, it seems there. But I would encourage the commission to take a look at, any strategically, and I guess you are, looking at your service delivery plan, because it's clear that the population has changed their views on what's acceptable, and certainly I understand safety concerns and all of that, but change it before the people get fed up and change it themselves.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
We're going to move on. Next, we have a report on from the Oregon Growth Board.
Who's doing this? Paul here?
Yep. There he is. Recognizing that you really hardly have had a chance to do very much yet, but just kind of wanted to understand what's going on.
Absolutely. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Paul Grove with the Oregon Business Development Department. Appreciate the opportunity today to talk a little bit about the work of the Growth Board to date. I'll keep my remarks brief and really just discuss kind of the background that got us to this point. As you're familiar with, House Bill 4040, the Oregon Investment Act, passed in February. And that bill was the process, or the result of a year-long process that started with Governor Kitzhaber's Economic Development Transition Team that was led by Treasurer Wheeler, Representative Reed, and Wally Van Valkenburg, who's the chair of the Business Development Commission. And the group traveled around the state and listened to private businesses, economic development organizations, etc. And throughout their travels, throughout their meetings, they heard a common theme, and that was about improving the access to capital for Oregon companies. The board, or the transition team, met, worked on a series of recommendations that were ultimately submitted to the Oregon Business Plan in December 2011, and those recommendations served as the basis for House Bill 4040, like I said, that was passed in February. In particular, the board is required to submit a report to the legislature January 2013 regarding this issue, and not only improving access to capital for Oregon companies, but also the administration and oversight of the Oregon Growth Account. So with that, I will hand it over to Chair Langler, and he can discuss in greater detail the work of the board.
Thanks, Paul. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Jerry Langler from Portland, and I am Managing Director of OVP Venture Partners there, co-chair of the Oregon Growth Board. My other co-chair is Patty Moss from Bend. I think there are a couple things I would reflect on for your benefit. One is, this is early. I appreciate, Chair Beyer, you giving us that almost pass, because we are scrambling here after only a couple of months and a couple of meetings. But we have made some progress, and I think there are a couple areas where I would indicate to you where we have. One is we asked staff to help put together an inventory of what are all the economic development programs in the state where capital access is helpful. And that is everything from equity capital to growth capital via debt or loan guarantees, all the way to including infrastructure development for appropriate land use. The fact that that inventory was not easily available was the first interesting step. Staff has worked very hard, and I think they've done a nice job pulling it together. But nobody could actually sit down and say, here are all the things that the state does to help provide capital to help grow businesses. We're getting close to having our arms around that now. In the process of doing that, we have, I think, bucketed three areas for simplicity. One is essentially creation capital. What's money available to start companies? Growth capital, you have a company, how do you help it grow? And then infrastructure, you need to provide the facilities, the whatever, for companies to grow, or to site and grow. And so we're kind of getting to that level of detail. And in addition, looking at what other states have done. So we are definitely not too proud to steal. We've looked at the state of Utah, the state of Ohio, state of Michigan. They have some very interesting programs, some of which you may see coming to you in January as proposals and legislation, but we're too early to forecast that yet. I think the analogy that we are starting to use, and you may have heard during the Senate testimony, I'm not sure, but is ultimately this group could get to be a parallel organization to what the Oregon Investment Council does with pension funds, where you have a body that basically looks at a whole set of assets and tries to optimize the returns for the pensioners by changing asset allocation over time, by being nimble when opportunities arise. And so today we think the state is not in that situation for growth capital for businesses. Over time, and this would not be in the first year, we would hope to get to the point where we might be able to look at you and say, we are in that situation where we have a good understanding of what we can do. We have evidence that we are doing it, so we're going to walk before we run here, and that we are, in fact, nimble and able to take the limited resources of the state and use them wisely to help create and grow businesses with high-paying jobs. And with that, I will be happy to take questions.
Thank you, sir. I assume you're looking at both the debt and equity sides?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
I heard Nick Fowler from Corvallis area. I don't know if you know Nick. He's expressed a lot of his companies that he's working with. He says the hardest thing he's found is when they're ready to roll out. They're ready to manufacture, but getting the debt piece of that in place.
Chair Beyer, I think that's absolutely true. And I happen to come from the equity side in my background, but that we have three members on the board who are from the banking or credit union sector, so they really do understand the debt environment, and we absolutely are leaning on them to look at those issues, particularly given the lack of credit availability we've seen in the recent years.
Good. Questions? Senator Gerard?
Did you look at the impact of 66 and 67 as to the availability of capital? I mean, obviously, I think capital with the passage of 66 and 67 has become a lot harder to find, but maybe, I mean,
Senator Rudd, we have not looked at that broader issue yet. I think that one of the things we are very cognizant of is when you start talking about capital availability and job creation, it essentially touches everything, right? It touches tax policy. It touches education policy. You know, we could go down a long and winding path there. We may get there someday and come back to you with thoughts, but I think we believe that right now we have some much easier and more straightforward ways to be helpful than to deal with that. But it's not to say that we won't talk about it and ultimately come back to you. I mean, you know, I have my personal belief, you know, as I said to a friend of mine, if you look at the very large homes on the south shore of the Columbia River, it's clear that there was some impact of capital moving outside the state that could have been used here. But frankly, I think we can actually do a lot without worrying about tax policy in the short term.
Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
Just, you know, I think probably there is some evidence that the 66 impact would lead to some of those large houses. But as far as Measure 67, the latest Ernst & Young study shows that we are still, you know, almost dead last in the country in terms of overall corporate tax burden.
Mm-hmm.
The individual tax burden is probably more problematical.
Yes, Senator Burdick, and again, we haven't gone there, but I would personally agree with you that I think that's true.
Well, we're not in the Revenue Committee right now. But the chair of the Revenue Committee is here. Anything else? Well, I wish you good luck. It's really important what you're doing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Byron. And again, we will be back to you by January with a report and recommendations.
We're looking forward to that. I am hearing
meat on the bones from today.
People are calling me up asking about the state bank idea again. I think, well, we've done something else. That's still out there. Okay. Thank you. That is all we have for information. Colleagues, I remind you that our next meeting in December will be the always popular introducing of committee bills. I would ask, I know I've been talking with Patrick about a number, and I suspect you all have too, and if there are things that you would like to have introduced in December, the normal protocol is that, at least as I remember it, is we'll committee will introduce any bill that members wish to bring forward without any commitment to support it when it's in. So, but it would be helpful to Patrick and me if you would let him know, let him know what you're doing so we can at least have an idea of what's going to be on the agenda.
And Mr. Chair, if I might just remind committee members, the deadline for submitting drafting requests to Legislative Council is Monday. This Monday is the deadline for submitting drafting requests to Legislative Council for a pre-session filing of measures. So.
Is there anything else? Seeing none, we are adjourned.